All right, good morning, everybody. Let's open up to Romans 13, please. Very briefly and temporarily, as we will be moving from there here in a bit. We're actually going to be spending most of our time in the book of Job today, believe it or not. So we've been talking about the last few weeks the concept of Romans chapter 13, verse 8, which states, "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law." So the concept that we're talking about here is what divine love is and what it looks like and how it gets manifested. Now, last week we discussed the concept of divine love specifically out of Ephesians chapter 3, that this concept of divine love really is designed to extend itself to the utmost, to the very end, where someone, even though they get hurt, they still love, they still sacrifice, they still have the other person's best interest in mind. And that's something that the world doesn't understand, comprehend, or is able to do. Typically in the world, we all have limits as to how much we're going to allow ourselves to get hurt before we cut off that relationship. And one of the labels for that relationship, kind of relationship, is that it's toxic. You know, we're all about eliminating toxic relationships. And I think that there is an extent to where you do have to limit yourself to a certain extent from these types of aspects. However, when it comes to the church, one of the things that we do when it comes to folks that are in the world is that even though experience might tell us that I put myself out there for the world, I put myself out there for people, and I end up just always getting hurt because people have a tendency of taking your sacrifice and taking your love and stepping on it. Well, that's what God experiences all the time. But what does he do? He still keeps offering, doesn't he? He still keeps putting himself out there. And so we get to do the same thing. And the admonition and the encouragement for last week was, let's not have our heart get calloused. Let's make sure that we continue to put ourselves out there and allow God in his work with us to strengthen us to do that. I mean, if we're operating by our own strength, yeah, you're going to want to hold back because you can only get hurt so many times before you start to crumble yourselves. But that's the thing about divine love. Divine love is able to continue to renew you and heal you so that you can continue to put yourself out there and give people the full divine love experience without pulling back and not showing them a true vision of who Christ, Jesus Christ really is. Now, when it comes to our relationships with each other, that divine love is important to continue to show in the household of faith among fellow Christians. And what I want to talk about today is what every single relationship on the face of the earth is based on. Without fail. Trust. Every relationship that we have is based on trust. Now, is trust necessary among members in the body of Christ? Well, of course. Of course. As a matter of fact, I think the relationships inside the body of Christ depend upon trust more so than other relationships out in the world. Because we've all committed to a certain ideology. We've committed to a certain course of action. We've consented to a specific renewal of the mind and of the character. Let's head over to Psalm 118 for a moment. This is the messianic prophecy, so this is coming from the viewpoint of the Messiah. But the principle applies to us too. Let's look at verse 8. "It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in man. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes." It looks like we're not supposed to trust in people. Well, if we look at the context of this passage, what he's talking about is in the realm of his life and his ministry and who he's going to trust to save him. Is Jesus going to, or did Jesus trust in man or government to save him in his life? Absolutely not. He trusted in God. But did Jesus have trust in relationships? If Jesus didn't trust the church to do what she was supposed to do, he certainly wouldn't have left her in charge of getting this work done out here. He has absolute trust in the church that the church is going to fulfill its purpose and be a bride suitable for him. There's trust there. There are encouraging verses also about the concept of relationships and friendships. Let's head over to Ecclesiastes chapter 4 for a second. Ecclesiastes 4, starting in verse 9. It says, two are better than one, because they have good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when he has not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they can keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. So he's talking about the benefit of relationships in the real world. I mean, I don't know how often we find ourselves alone and cold and needing to, you know, snuggle up with somebody. That must have been a thing back in those days a little bit more than what they are today. No offense if I don't want to snuggle up with you if I get cold. But, you know, if our lives depended on it, that would be really good. I mean, there's no tauntauns to split in half and put people inside of, right? Star Wars reference. No? Okay. That was bad, right? I know. Sorry. I'm a kid of the 80s. A lot of my pop culture references are from the 80s, and maybe they don't flow too well over in the modern day. There's going to be Star Wars people that listen to this, and they're going to LOL at that one. At least I thought that in my head. Now, here's a question. Is our relationship with God built on trust? That he's going to do what he said he's going to do? Yeah. That's the fundamental basis. And as a matter of fact, it's one of the fundamental bases that God puts forward to us as to why we can have a relationship with him. You can trust me. There's a Hebrew word, and that word is translated loving kindness in the New American Standard. It's the Hebrew word chesed. And what it means, literally, if you were to define the concept, it means covenant faithfulness. That when God puts forth a word of covenant, of promise, of whatever it might be, you can 100% trust that he is going to be faithful to that. I mean, over in 2 Timothy, it says, if we are faithless, he remains faithful because he cannot deny himself. Talk about trust. God cannot deny himself. But also, that word chesed is also used of interpersonal relationships. Let's head over to 1 Samuel chapter 20. I'm going to be building quite a bit of a foundation here for what we're going to get to here at the end. And I hope we're going to get through it all today, but you know how that works. Now, I probably should have told you to answer this question before we turned here. When you think of some of the best, or probably one of the best friendships in the Bible, who comes to mind? David and Jonathan, right? David and Jonathan, one of the best friendships. And it really relates back to this concept of covenant faithfulness, because Jonathan was Saul's kid. In other words, when Saul checked out of this world, if we were going to go by the laws of heredity, who would have been king? Would have been Jonathan. But he recognized something. He recognized that God had ordained David to be king, and Jonathan said, essentially, as what we'll see, I'm going to follow you. I'm going to give up my right to the throne because God has said you're king. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to, in this whole battle between you and my dad, I'm going to reject my father. And I'm going to side with God's anointed. And I'm going to tell you all of the things that he's plotting against you so that you can live. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 20. Let's look at verse 12. It says, then Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if there is a good feeling toward David, shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away that you may go in safety. And may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. If I am still alive, will you not show me loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die? You shall not cut off a loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. Jonathan made a vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. Notice that relationship. So here, the relationship of David and Jonathan was actually a life and death relationship, wasn't it? David had to trust Jonathan with his life, with the information that Jonathan was providing to David. Now, if we flip over to chapter 23, look at verse 15. It says, now David became aware that Saul had come to seek his life while David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh and encouraged him in God. Thus he said to him, do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, will not find you. And you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul, my father, knows that also. So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went up to his house. Isn't that a great little passage of scripture? Remember, Jonathan was heir to the throne. But he knew who David was, and so he was willing to follow David and swear a covenant that he would protect him against his own father. This is an illustration of the types of relationships that should be in the church. We should have the expectation that we should be able to trust each other. And we're going to talk about some of the caveats to this here in a moment. But I want to talk first off, after we got done with that little bit of an intro, what's the purpose of relationships and friendships? What's the purpose of them? Well, let's head over to Job. Chapter 2. Now, we know the context of the book of Job. Job is a great guy. Satan accused Job of, and of God, Job only being faithful because God had placed a hedge around him. And he told God, you remove that hedge, Job will curse you to your face. And so we see what happens. Job had everything that he had taken away. He had his family taken away. And then he had his health taken away. And in all these things, Job did not sin. He did not rebel against God. Now, right after Job had lost everything, a few of his friends popped over. They popped over to encourage Job. So let's follow. This isn't exhaustive. There's a lot of things that we're not going to be covering. But there is a whole course of events and series of conversations that go back and forth in this that give us an illustration of how things are supposed to be, how they turned out, and how God responded to them. Job chapter 2, starting in verse 11. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamanite. And they made an appointment together to come and sympathize with him and comfort him. Oh, that's sweet. We got three friends. Also, the shortest man ever recorded in the Bible. Bildad the Shuhite. Ba-boom. Diane just shakes her head. Oh, that's two bad jokes in a row. What was that? The best puns are the ones that make you groan. Thank you for that encouragement. I'm gonna take that with me today. What was the purpose of them coming? What's one of the greatest purposes of having friends? They were there to comfort him in his adversity. At least that's why they intended to show up, right? Now let's go to verse 12. I love how this starts. When they lifted their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. Each of them tore his robe, threw dust over their heads toward the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. Do you ever get uncomfortable being around someone who's in great pain? Someone who maybe just lost somebody. Why? You don't know what to say a lot of times, right? What's the typical, one of the typical responses? I'm sorry for your loss. That's a genuine sentiment most of the time. Sometimes people say those things because they don't know what to say. It's difficult to know how to interact. And so we try to have grace with each other. Notice they started out great. What they did is they mourned with him according to the cultural concepts of mourning and empathy. They wept with him. For him. They tore their clothes. They threw dust on their head. That was the way they were very emotive. It's a very emotive culture. You know, they didn't wear their feelings close to the vest. They wore them on their sleeve. And then notice what they did. They didn't say anything. Because sometimes when pain is so great, there's nothing you can say. Sometimes a hug is one of the best things you can give someone who's suffering, so that you can avoid saying something awkward. Having gone through mourning periods, I've learned that sometimes saying nothing is better than saying something. Because I've had people say some really, they meant it in a nice way, but it was like a kick in the stomach. It just would have been better if they just would have been quiet and just given me a hug and said, I love you. That's one of the best things you can do. Now, if it's over social media or a text or a phone call or something like that, I mean, sometimes it's difficult to lay those things out there. I get it. And it's that's why sometimes we avoid even interacting when situations like this, because what do I say? Well, you know, pray for some wisdom and, you know, maybe think ahead of time about how to respond. But Job's friends did a really good job. And then what Job did in chapter 3, yeah, I'm not going to have time to get through all this, but we're going to get through Job today. Because there's really good stuff in here. And I think the concept of building trust and relationships is really super duper important. And we can take a couple of weeks on this. I think it's that important. Look what Job says after 7 days, verse 1 of chapter 3. Afterward, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. I tell you what, you lose everything that you own. you lose all of your kids, and then you lose your health. Now, let's think about Job for a second. Satan had the ability to inflict his health with whatever he wanted to, except he couldn't kill him. He struck Job with boils from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. I don't know what that would be like. But I would think, first glance, couldn't you do better than that? But then you take a step back and think for a second, this is Satan. He has unfettered access to curse Job, to inflict as much pain on Job as he possibly could. And he chose boils. Now, when you go and take a look at that, they can be some of the most painful things that you can ever have. And typically, you know, sometimes when you're suffering, you can typically get in a position in some way, shape, or form where you're at least somewhat comfortable. If you've got these things from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet, you're always on a pressure point and you're always in intense pain constantly. So yeah, he was in very rough shape. And with all of these things that are going on, he curses the day of his birth. But notice who he doesn't curse. He doesn't follow the advice of his wife in chapter 2. Curse God and die. He never did that. So he says, verse 3, let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said a boy is conceived. See, he's lamenting. And Job's friends, who started off so well, in chapter 4, look at chapter 4, verse 1. The first thing that comes out of Eliphaz's mouth here, then Eliphaz the Temanite answered, if one ventures a word with you, will you become impatient? But who can refrain from speaking? Behold, you have admonished many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have helped the tottering to stand, and you have strengthened feeble knees. And so he's kind of praising Job here. You've done really great things. But notice what he says in verse 5. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Remember now, look at this, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright destroyed? According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble harvest it. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they come to an end. The first words of comfort out of the mouth of Job's friends is, what'd you do, Job? What'd you do? You deserve this. You just need to be honest and admit what you did. Let's head over to chapter 6. And Job responds. Now, Eliphaz goes on for a while. He goes in through chapter 4, chapter 5. And let's check out verse 14. For the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friends, so that he does not forsake the fear of the Almighty. My brothers have acted deceitfully like a wadi, like the torrents of wadis which vanish, which are turbid because of ice, into which the snow melts. Where they become waterless, they are silent. When they become waterless, they are silent. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. So what's Job say? What's the purpose of the friends? Especially friends like this. They're supposed to encourage them not to forsake the Lord. They're there to give kindness. See, this is built on trust. And then he says, my brothers have acted deceitfully like a wadi. Anybody know what a wadi is? A wadi is a stream or a creek that only flows certain times of the year. Only when there's an abundance of water. So you see a stream coming and maybe you're traveling through parched lands and you see a stream of water there and you mark it in your mind. You say, okay, if I come through here again, I'm going to be able to find some water here. I mean, because they can't stop at a Sheetz or a gas station or something like that and grab a bottle of water. So then they're traveling through, it's hot outside, and they're like, I remember, there's a stream over here, I can get some water. And they come and it's dried up. It's deceitful. And it leaves them thirsty. Job's saying, that's you guys. You're here to provide, you're supposed to be here to provide kindness. You're here to remind me to trust in the Lord, and yet you're attacking me. That's not what the friendship is supposed to be. Now, let's go over to chapter 11. So Job goes ahead and describes, you know, hey guys, I know you think that I've done something really, 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 really bad here. I'm conscious of nothing against myself. I have no idea what I did. I've trusted in God. If I did something wrong, I'd admit it. So he says in chapter 11, verse 1, then Zophar the Naamathite answered, shall a multitude of words go unanswered, and a talkative man be acquitted? Shall your boast silence men, and shall you scoff and none rebuke? For you have said, my teaching is pure, and I am innocent in your eyes. But would that God might speak and open his lips against you and show you the secrets of wisdom. For sound wisdom has two sides. Know then that God forgets a part of your iniquity. What was Zophar saying here? Job, you're defending your innocence, but you have to be wrong. And you need to be rebuked. Remember where he's come from. Remember what he suffered. Now, we know the end of the story, and we know that Job didn't do anything to deserve this. That's the whole point. That's the whole entire point. See, and these friends assume they know what God is all about. Now, Moses, more than likely, the tradition holds that Moses wrote Job. So these guys are speaking really confidently without having a lick of scripture to go on. Let's head over to chapter 15. Let's look at verse 12. So this is Eliphaz again. He says, why does your heart carry you away? And why do your eyes flash? That you should turn your spirit against God and allow such words to go out of your mouth. What is man that he should be pure? Or he who is born of a woman that he should be righteous? Behold, he puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who is detestable and corrupt, man who drinks iniquity like water. Boy, you hear people talk like that today. Nobody can be righteous. Even the Christian? Nope. They can't act righteously. They're sinners constantly. See, so Job insisting, guys, I don't know what I did. I'm not conscious of anything. I don't have anything in my life that I'm aware of that would deserve this. And his friends just don't believe him. You're arrogant. You're boastful. Just admit it and be done with it. Nobody can be pure. And then over to chapter 16, look at how Job responds. Verse 1, then Job answered, I have heard many such things. Sorry comforters are you all. Is there no limit to windy words or what plagues you that you answer? I too could speak like you if I were in your place. I could compose words against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips could lessen your pain. What's Job saying there? You guys stink. You're horrible. I could speak like you, but then I could also strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips could lessen your pain. It's not what you're doing for me. And then head over to chapter 16, verses 18 through 22. He says, O earth, do not cover my blood, and let there be no resting place for my cry. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and my advocate is on high. My friends are my scoffers. My eye weeps to God. Oh, that a man might plead with his God as a man with his neighbor. For when a few years are past, I shall go the way of no return. See, Job realizes that the only course of action he has is with God. His friends are actually his enemies here. That is not what the relationships of the godly are supposed to be like. At all. There is supposed to be genuine love and concern and trust amongst them. Then chapter 18, verse 1. Then Bildad the Shuhite responded, How long will you hunt for words? Show understanding and then we can talk. Why are we regarded as beasts and stupid in your eyes? O you who tear yourself in your anger, for your sake is the earth to be abandoned or the rock to be moved from its place. Indeed, the light of the wicked goes out and the flame of his fire gives no light. The light in his tent is darkened and the lamp goes out above him. His vigorous stride is shortened and his own scheme brings him down. For he is thrown into the net by his own feet and he steps into the webbing. He keeps on going. Basically what he's saying here is, Job, again, is this arrogant individual. The wicked always suffer, and they don't suffer unless they're wicked. And he's making the assumption that Job is wicked in some way, shape, or form. And then in chapter 19 and verse 1, Job responds, and he says, How long will you torment me and crush me with words? These 10 times you have insulted me. You are not ashamed to wrong me. Even if I have truly erred, my error lodges with me. If indeed you vaunt yourselves against me and prove my disgrace to me, know then that God has wronged me and has closed his net around me. This is an intense conversation, isn't it? It's like you've insulted me. This man lost everything he owned, all of his children, and he's sitting there writhing in pain. And all they do is insult and accuse him. And then finally, let's flip over to chapter 42. So here's the situation. Job's three friends, and plus you got Elihu. Yeah, Elihu. He's a youngster, and he just goes off the rails real fast. So here's the situation. You got Job, who says, I didn't do anything wrong. You got his buddies that say, yeah, you did. Job says, no, I didn't. His friends say, yeah, you did. And the only way this is going to work out, Job, is if you say what you did. You're wicked, and you're adding to your wickedness by saying this. Then God weighs in. And here's what he says. Verse 7. Now, hold on. Job did start feeling sorry for himself quite a bit. And when you go back starting in verse 38, you get God's response to Job. Job needed to have his attitude and thought process checked a little bit. But then you look at verse 7. It says, It came about after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, My wrath is kindled against you and your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Now therefore, take for yourself 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourself, and my servant Job will pray for you. For I will accept him that I may not do with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken of what is right, as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite went and did as the Lord told them, and the Lord accepted Job. Every single thing that those three guys spoke was wrong. They made a lot of assumptions about God, and they didn't give their friend the compassion and the love that the trust in the relationship demanded needed to be there. Now, there's much more in Job, but again, this is the part that I wanted to focus on. My point is this, and we're going to finish this out next week. The concept of trust in relationships is exceedingly important. It's the base currency that every relationship depends upon. What we're going to talk about next week is how God defines this trust in the New Testament specifically, because God uses relationships, specific types of relationships, to describe our interaction with each other. And then what we're going to discuss is what happens when trust gets broken. To give you a little bit of that now, because I think it's important. There are minor breaches and there are major breaches. A minor breach, someone asks you to do something, you forget. That's a little bit of a breach of trust because they trusted you to get something done, you forgot, and you didn't get it done. Well, how's that resolved? Well, you say, I'm sorry, and then you go and do it. Trust restored. Now, if you happen to do that over and over and over and over and over again, not doing what you said you were going to do, then the small little breach becomes a little bit of a bigger breach, and you possibly become a person that people can't trust to do what you said you're going to do. And that's not a place that anybody wants to be. But then you have major breaches of trust, which are a violation, an utter violation of the core principles of the relationship. And that can happen in a variety of different ways. When it comes to the church, one of the worst breaches of trust that you can do is where you destroy the faith of others. You put stumbling blocks in your brother or sister's way, or you become a danger to the church itself. And what's the response? How do those breaches of trust get fixed? There's only one way. Absolute, utter honesty and humility. And an accountability that states, whatever you need from me to restore that trust, I'll gladly do. Without that honesty and humility, when trust has been broken in the church with major breaches of trust, if honesty and humility and accountability are not being offered by the person who broke trust, the relationship can never be restored. And the only way for the church to function, and that's the last part we're going to get to next week, the only way for the church to function as she's supposed to function, to be the light to the world, to be the glory of God to the nation so that they see and are attracted to that, is if the people in the church have trust with God, have trust with each other, and are all committed to engaging in the process of building up trust if it ever gets broken. Even in areas of big breaches can be fixed. That's part of the glory of the church and the glory of God. We can fix major breaches of trust, but only if the divine process is followed. It's the only way. So we'll stop there and we'll finish up next week to lay all those things out.